Tick-tock, tick-tock. The end of the month is fast approaching, and that means time is running out to complete the 2020 census. This is the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
With only a few days left on the census, we check in with counties in East Texas, Far West Texas, and Southwest Texas. A U.S. Congresswoman tells us why she was moved to introduce legislation after the gruesome murder of Fort Hood Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen. On COVID, we check in with San Antonio, and we tell you why some COVID tests are so expensive. We check in with some new homeschoolers and poetry inspired by this crazy going back to school moment. All that and more. This is the Texas Standard. From deep in the heart of Texas, this is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Thank you for listening on this Thursday, the 17th day of September 2020. Yes, it is a census year. And yes, time is running out to participate in the process. As you may know, the Trump administration cut the nationwide population count short by a month. So now it's set to end on September 30th. As of right now, according to Census Bureau data, about 92% of Texas households have been tallied, but there are some counties that have a much lower response rate. And you've been hearing that an inaccurate count would have major consequences for all of Texas. Things like possibly missing out on new seats in the U.S. House, largely driven by growth in the Latino population. It could also mean the state could lose hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding. It is a huge deal. That's why we thought we needed three guests for this conversation. Joining me now is Lonnie Hunt, Director of the Deep East Texas Council of Governments. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Lonnie.
Thank you very much.
We also have Sarah Hidalgo Cook. She's the General Manager of the Southwest Area Regional Transit District. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Denise Vasquez is Research Coordinator for the UT Health Science Center at Houston El Paso campus. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you for having me.
So for all three of you, I would like to hear a little bit about the census response rate in your community. Can we start there?
Yes. I'll start in Deep East Texas, which is a 12-county region in the eastern part of the state. And unfortunately, our response rate is not as high as we'd like for it to be. Our number one response county is Angelina County, which is at 56.2%, okay. But we go all the way down to Sabine County, which is only at 30.4% at the moment.
Denise, Sarah?
Okay, well, in our area, which is the southwest part of Texas, as for our region, we're an 8-county region, and we're at about 30%. Our largest county is at a little bit over 52%.
Out here in far west Texas, in El Paso County, we have a response rate currently of 65.1%. But our neighboring counties of Hudspeth and Culberson County are below 25%.
Well, let me ask all of you this. What are the biggest barriers that your community is facing to participate in the census? Who wants to start?
The biggest problem that we've had is because we are such a rural area, most of the households in our region did not receive anything in the mail from the Census Bureau, which I don't frankly understand, because even rural people have mailboxes and 911 addresses and get mail every day. But the Census Bureau, the strategy from the start was that they were not going to mail things out to rural households. And if you look at the numbers in our region, and I think based on what I've seen and heard around the state, it's true everywhere. The more rural households you have, which means the less households that got anything in the mail from the Census Bureau, the lower the self-response rate is.
Sarah, you had an issue with things in the mail as well, right?
Yes. Our particular area is extremely rural. Many of our counties, we have what's considered colonias. Mm-hmm. And so in these colonias, there is not an actual mailbox. And the infrastructure is still substantially not up to par. So they have P.O. boxes. And of course, my understanding is that the P.O. boxes were not going to be of a formal way of mailing out census information because of the fact that P.O. boxes change so drastically constantly throughout the year. We have seen some enumerators out, but basically in these rural areas, they're just not answering their doors. COVID-related. It could be COVID-related.
Okay.
It could also just be the fact that there's such a misconception of the census. They're afraid to answer the census, with maybe a fear of losing some type of benefit that they receive from the state. Also, just the fact that, we find nowadays that it's a lot harder to have residents in these communities to kind of do their due diligence to, as far as civil duties. And so it's difficult.
What do you mean by that? I don't understand that.
Well, it's kind of the same thing, when somebody gets called in for jury duty, you have a large percentage of people that just don't do it. And I think the same thing is with the census. They just don't feel that there's a need. They don't understand how it does impact them on a daily basis, with funds coming in through the state and congressional seats. I think that, it's not of interest to them because they don't realize how much it does really impact their day-to-day life.
I see. So beyond the misconceptions, your organizations have a lot of things that are challenging, cutting the count short by a month, a global, not regional, not state, not national, but a global pandemic. So how has this affected the efforts that all of you see from the different organizations that are participating in the count?
It's caused us to totally change what we had originally planned. We had planned to put boots on the ground in all 12 of our counties. We had contracted with local people, well-known local people who are very visible in their community, that were going to be our census outreach coordinators, not taking the census for the Census Bureau, but just promoting the census. And they were going to get out and go to events and schools and churches and, community meetings. And of course, when the pandemic hit, all those meetings got canceled. And so we had to totally retool our whole effort. And we still have those coordinators in each county, but they're just not able to get out and have that one-on-one interaction like we had hoped. So we went to a lot of media advertising, social media, et cetera. But then again, we're in an area that's greatly underserved with broadband. It's just like it's almost like one thing after another that's causing concern with me that we're going to end up with an undercount.
Denise or Sarah, do you guys want to add anything?
I think I reiterate the same thing. I believe that the fact that the first part of the census was able to be performed through online, and I think that's an issue in our area where connectivity is very difficult in some of our colonias and some of our ranch areas, as well as you have those more the elderly and those that are low income that just don't have that expertise to go online and do that kind of stuff. The other thing also would be the same thing with events. We completely, we're going to be providing quite a bit of information with the boots on the ground as well. That had to change. So we're back to literally calling people, calling our clients. We estimated, about anywhere from 600 to 900 riders per day that we would be educating on and disseminating information to. And after COVID started, of course, our ridership fell by about 70%. So at that point, it became trying to call people on the phone, social media blast, newspaper blast, and then any event that was being held, trying to attend all those events.
With everything that we have talked about, I'd like to ask, what is the best advice that you have for people in your community who have not been counted? Sarah, do you want to start?
Sure. I would definitely encourage them to go ahead and find some type of avenue to get some information on how they can fill out the census. And they can also visit our website at www.paseosort.org.
Denise.
We work with our project with a team of community health workers, and some of them have been hired by the U.S. Census Bureau as enumerators. And they tell us, for example, 20 households only of those 20, only four, you know, opened their doors and got their surveys completed. I would say to everyone to please help us make sure that your neighbors, your family has been counted. Check in with them, ask them if they've completed it. If they haven't, help them, connect them to the numbers and also to the local organizations who are out there daily helping people to complete their census survey. Please, please complete it because this is going to help you recover. It's going to help our communities recover from the pandemic.
Lonnie.
I would say we still have time. I know time is getting away, and September 30th will be here soon, but there is still time to respond. Check on your neighbors, your family members, your friends, your coworkers, and don't assume anything because we've talked about hard-to-count populations. People don't think about young professionals as being hard to count, but there is a lot of 30-year-old professionals out there that have never done a census before because 10 years ago they were in college and their parents completed it for them. Mm-hmm. So don't assume anything. Don't take anything for granted. Talk it up with everybody.
We've been speaking with Denise Vasquez, research coordinator for the UT Health Science Center at Houston, El Paso campus. Also with Lonnie Hunt, director of the Deep East Texas Council of Governments, and with Sarah Hidalgo Cook, general manager for the Southwest Area Regional Transit District. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And joining me now is social media editor Wells Dunbar. He monitors the Talk of Texas Online. What are you seeing, Wells? Hello.
Hey, Joy. Good to be with you. Hearing from folks about the census. I know. I love our time together, Joy.
Yes.
Here's what we're hearing about the census. Linda Pallett has an interesting perspective on her Facebook page. She says, "The census undercount and voter suppression are two sides of the same effort to underrepresent parts of the population." Here's a comment on her Facebook page from Allie Reginini about her specific concern. She says, "I live in Hays County in Central Texas and am concerned specifically about our count in San Marcos. Those census forms came out pretty much as soon as the Texas State campus shut down, so I have a feeling we will be very undercounted." And echoing some of what we just heard, this comment via Twitter from H. Michael Karshish. He says, "It takes literally 5 minutes. It's so easy to do your part for all of Texas.
If you have internet access, that is."
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
And you know, I'd like to remind everybody, don't go anywhere, Wells, but if Wells Dunbar has not seen you, find him on Facebook or on Twitter. He's a Texas Standard. Will you join us again before the show ends?
You know I will, Joy.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Millions of students nationwide remain at home in this pandemic, learning on district laptops, on tablets. Some children are now back in class and others should return soon, but this one family in Hearst, Texas won't go back. KERA's Bill Zeebel introduces us to some new homeschoolers.
It's a warm weekday morning in this tree-lined neighborhood of Hearst. 7-year-old Molly Gilchrist is playing in her driveway with the rest of her family. She went to Bedford Heights Elementary School last year, but hasn't been back since COVID-19 closed it last March. She's been learning at home ever since.
Well, I don't get to see my friends that much in homeschool, but at homeschool, I get to go on field trips, and I've never been on one in public school.
We've done a couple of field trips because we still want to be able to socialize them and get them out.
That's mom Tricia Gilchrist. Once COVID-19 closed the schools, she tried to untangle her Hearst Euless Bedford School District's online plans for teaching her kids. More recently, though, she's been learning how to teach them herself, making all of North Texas a classroom.
it just being our family, we have more of an opportunity to take them on field trips, whereas, you know, in public school, they do maybe one field trip a year. And last year, their field trip got canceled. They came home for spring break and never were able to go back. And so she was very disappointed in having to miss her field trip last year. Here, we've gotten to do a couple to make up for that.
Trisha and husband Scott are the tag team teaching their four kids. The youngest, 18-month-old Riggins, is sleeping inside. Everyone else is outdoors under a shady tree or running around, like their 5-year-old.
Beau. B-E-A-U.
B-E-A-U.
Molly, we've met. She's 7. The oldest is 8.
Ellie, and I spell my name like E-L-L-I-E.
Mom and Dad both grew up here and still love the HEB district and their kids' school.
We love the teachers, the faculty, everybody. But this year, with all of the COVID regulations, it just seemed hard for them to learn in front of a computer screen for 8 hours a day with our kids being as young as they are. It just didn't seem the best option for our family.
So they chose the homeschool option. They'd already been considering it. For one thing, the Gilchrists work out of their house. Homeschooling may free up more time for travel, which they love. They're also devout Christians. The pandemic provided the perfect excuse to teach their kids the way they want to.
It definitely helped us consider this and do some hard research and thinking and thoughtful prayer through it. And I'd say it was definitely a big impact on our decision.
Because faith influences every decision they make, they've chosen a Christian homeschool curriculum called The Good and the Beautiful. Trisha says it makes teaching easy.
The curriculum tells you exactly what to say, when to say it. It provides activities to do. The schooling part is great. It's trying to figure out our new rhythm, which has been more difficult.
They both figure that'll come with time.
But, hey, we're on week 4. You know, it's hard to assess anything when you're only 4 weeks in. But we're having a blast.
If that changes, they can always re-enroll in the district. The pandemic was a key reason for homeschooling in the first place. But an approved vaccine would not be enough to send them back.
You know, we've always consulted our doctors and pediatricians and all of that and everything we do, but we don't just believe everything that they say. We look into all angles. I can confidently say we would not get a COVID vaccine.
Gilchrist is also confident that a recent field trip to the aquarium was good for daughter Molly.
I saw a sloth and learned that they don't scream. It slept most of the whole time.
The Gilchrists aren't screaming either, even though they've taken on homeschooling for the first time in their lives. I'm Bill Zeeble in Hearst.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. This year's Major League Baseball season, like everything else, is a little unusual because of the pandemic. But if you like your baseball really unusual and you want to get part of the game, may I suggest Blazeball? It's a brand new web-based fantasy baseball game that our tech expert Omar Gallaga has been playing and writing about it. And he says it's a lot of fun, but also it's pretty weird. Omar is here to explain. Welcome back, Omar. How are you?
Hey, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Talk to me about Blazeball. What is that?
Well, let me put this up front. I'm not a baseball person. I don't know anything about baseball. I don't keep up with stats. I don't know anything about it. So it was surprising that this kind of caught my imagination, because it's fantasy baseball, but it's made up teams. You know, think teams like the Mexico City Wild Wings, now the Mexico City Mild Wings, the Canada Moist Talkers, the San Francisco Lovers. I mean, they're made up teams, made up players, and there's demons and people get incinerated by umpires and all these, and there's peanut brain.
And that doesn't happen in real baseball, thank God.
Not that I am aware of. No, it's no one. If it was, I'd be a fan. So all these weird things happen in this game. And really, it's sort of almost like a creative writing and art project, because the fans of the game that it launched in July as this kind of side project, it really blew up. And now there are Twitter accounts for all the players. There's all these beautiful pieces of artwork, you know, of these fictional players. And they all have their own, you know, backstories. And it's gotten really interesting. So it's almost like a creative writing and art project between the developers of the game, who were not expecting this to blow up, and all of these fans online who are sort of building all of the storylines and fiction around the game. It's really, really funny and fascinating.
So who were the geniuses? Where did this come from?
This came from a company called The Game Band. They're based out of Los Angeles. And previously they had made a game for iPad called Where Cards Fall, which was this gorgeous, you know, adventure game. So this is really, so to speak, left field for them. Like this was supposed to be like this very small text-based free web project. And I think it took them by surprise that it has really kind of exploded.
Well, tell me a little bit about the quirky players, the personalities in the game.
Yeah, there's Jessica Telephone, who appeared fully formed from a telephone booth and exists in every decade where there were telephones. There is Miguel Wheeler, who is literally a tire with rats inside of it and a bat tied to the side of it.
Oh, my God.
He's a player. There is Gunther O'Brien, a penguin with a shoe on his head. I mean, it's just like this very weird random roster of players, and they all have their own stats, you know, pitching, hitting, and the games actually play out in somewhat real time. There's a game every hour, and the season goes for a week. So you actually can watch the games online, you know, as text, you know, telling you what's happening in each inning, and people bet on the games with virtual currency. Oh. And that's sort of the main mechanic of the game, is you're betting on these games and building up currency to buy things and vote in elections. It's a whole mythology that has been built since July. It's really been amazing to watch it grow.
So I don't want to say this way out loud, but are you any good at it?
Well, I'm up to almost 10,000 coins, which is pretty well.
Is that good?
It's not a hard game to play. I mean, it's really just betting on, and they tell you the odds of the games and who's probably going to win, and you can bet on it based on that. So it's really not hard to build up currency. But the fun of it, I think, is everything around the game, is all of these storylines and all of these player bios and things that are sort of evolving around it. I mean, the game itself is very basic and interesting, but I think what's way more interesting is just this evolving creative universe around it.
Is that what makes it work during the pandemic? All of those attributes that you have mentioned?
Yeah, I think so, because I mean, I see a lot of non-sports fans, people who are not really getting into the new, you know, the new basketball season and baseball games, are really latching onto this as sort of like a sports-like distraction for people that are not into sports, because it does have those elements. It's kind of got fantasy elements and kind of science fiction elements, very, very much geared toward, you know, geeky people who spend a lot of time online and maybe don't follow sports.
Omar Gallaga covers tech at techminutetexas.com. Thank you so much for being here, Omar.
Thank you so much. Play ball.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has spared the life of a death row inmate due to his intellectual disability. The decision Wednesday changes Juan Lizcano's sentence to life in prison without parole. The 43-year-old was convicted of fatally shooting Dallas police officer Brian Jackson. A woman alleging she was sexually assaulted by guards at a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in El Paso has been deported to Mexico. KERA's Mallory Falk reports she was a witness in an open investigation.
The woman was one of three detainees who said they were sexually harassed or assaulted at the El Paso Processing Center. In a complaint filed last month, she said multiple guards forcibly kissed and touched her out of view of security cameras. The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General launched an investigation. The woman met with investigators for several hours, giving them a tour of the facility, pointing out camera blind spots, and offering multiple leads, according to her lawyer, Linda Corchado.
I think under circumstances like this, really the main goal and the priority for investigators is to protect your main asset. And they really made the wrong decision by giving ICE the green light
to deport her. ICE confirmed the woman was deported Monday. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Democrats in the Texas House are urging Republican Governor Greg Abbott to expand Medicaid to ensure as many Texans as possible have health coverage during the coronavirus pandemic. Texas is one of 12 states that have declined to do so under the Affordable Care Act. Houston Democratic Representative Garnett Coleman says expanding Medicaid will be his party's top priority in the next legislative session if Abbott refuses to act.
We have our work cut out for us, but we can do it. As a matter of fact, right now, all Governor Abbott has to do is pick up the phone and call the Health and Human Services Commissioner and tell him to do it. But that seems to be a problem making that phone call.
Coleman says the move would help an additional 1.5 to 2 million Texans get health insurance. And while the number of new coronavirus cases in Texas has been trending downwards since hitting record highs in July, one city is seeing an uptick in infections is Amarillo. The city's public health director, Casey Stoughton, explained what's behind the increase during a briefing yesterday.
So as school is certainly in full force, as we're just a couple weeks out from Labor Day celebrations, I think that we're seeing increases in cases from both of those scenarios.
The Amarillo area has nearly 800 active cases. I'm Joseph Leahy.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
It's 33 minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz. When it comes to prices, how medical procedures get their pricing is a bit of a mystery in the United States. It's not often that you find a hospital that will hand you a menu of their services. And of course, tests for COVID-19 are no exception. It seems that how much they cost depends on who's administering the test and on whether or not you have insurance. That's the upshot of a new report by researchers at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us now to tell us more is Gwendolyn Wu, healthcare and business reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Gwendolyn, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
The headline of your story is very telling. Let me read it. COVID-19 test costs range from 1 cent to $14,750. What? Where's that disparity coming from?
Well, that's a great question. When I saw that line in the study myself, I was like, wait a minute, $14,000, you could pay tuition at college.
You thought I'm misreading this, right?
Right. And, you know, this is kind of where everything is starting to come to a head now that we're a few months into the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the reason why the numbers range so widely is because in the federal relief packages for coronavirus, you were starting to see this provision saying that essentially providers who are out of network, they have full discretion over how much their cash prices are for coronavirus testing.
Really?
Yes. You know, there are two legislative relief packages for coronavirus. And essentially, they say that insurers must cover the costs of testing from an out-of-network provider at full cost at whatever cash price is listed on their website.
Wow.
Now, some insurers are alleging that those cash prices, providers aren't being transparent about them. And because of that, they're charging, you know, however much wants to be billed to the insurer. So I spoke with somebody at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas recently, and they showed me some de-identified claims that showed that there were certain out-of-network providers in the state of Texas that mm-hmm. were charging $4,000 for a COVID-19 wow. test. Now, the provisions in the legislative packages have some language that allows insurers to negotiate whether or not those are actually going to be the prices that they pay. But ultimately, they have to arrive at some form of payment. And I imagine there are some providers that aren't budging on how mm-hmm. much they are charging these insurers for testing.
Now, you're a healthcare and business reporter, so you are in the center and you know a lot about this. So is it normal for healthcare providers? I mean, is the sky the limit on what they're able to charge? Normally?
Usually, a market already exists for the kind of services that we render. You know how much a knee replacement generally is going to be when you go in.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about COVID-19 so far, though, is that we're still fairly early on in the pandemic, all things considered. And so testing prices are just kind of where demand is. And demand is still pretty high for COVID-19
Absolutely.
Tests.
Yeah. So in Texas, have you estimated the average cost and how does it compare to other states?
In the study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, Texas for antibody tests is pretty low. You know, they're charging less than average, about $56 per test, while for diagnostic tests, which is the most common type of test people are taking, the average price is somewhere between $103 to $144.
Okay.
Now, some insurers I've spoke with have said the average is kind of inching closer to between $140 and $155 here in Houston, but that's just an average. So you might see numbers all over the board for Texas.
And who's making money from these tests?
Really, there's a lot of costs down the line. You know, there's the cost of the test is much lower, actually, than $140 or so. The cost of a test might be closer to $45 or $50 or $60. But where you see these added costs along the line are, you know, the amount it takes to outsource it to the labs that can actually read the data. They're generated by administrative costs for administering the test, the additional cost of PPE. So really, along the way, you're seeing that these providers are requesting extra costs to make up for the fact that it takes time and resources to administer COVID-19 tests.
And ultimately, I mean, this is about the people, right? The patients. So what does it mean for patients who have insurance? And what does it mean for patients who do not, which we have so many in Texas?
Right now, there is some federal relief promise to help providers, bear the cost of administering tests to uninsured patients. There's a lot of patients, of course, who still do have insurance. And of course, those insurers are paying out those costs to providers to make up for that care. But it could be quite a while before we see exactly the economic and financial impact of COVID-19 testing at the rate that we're currently going.
We've been speaking with Gwendolyn Wu. She's a healthcare and business reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Gwendolyn, thank you so much for joining us at the Texas Standard.
Thanks again for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, reminding everyone to keep annual preventive and screening appointments. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes, so discussion with a doctor is encouraged. More at TexasOncology.com.
My name is Heidi Keneally. I live in Austin. I was inspired to write a poem on the day before school about doing school from home. Here's my poem. 'Twas the night before school Zooms, and all through the town, folks were looking for cords up and down. They sharpened their pencils and lined up their crayons and praised their dear teachers for sending out plans. The parents were weary, and they cursed 45 for not getting this demonic virus in line. Despite all the weirdness and all of the new, the children were bubbly with friends and work to do. Their minds may be addled from spring break without end, and their social skills lacking from no time with friends. They're excited for structure and hungry for knowledge, even if they may be in Zoom well into college. So from our house to yours, may we shout it out loud, Happy Zoom Days Eve. Please make us proud. I'm Heidi Keneally, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. San Antonio has reached a grim milestone. The local health department confirmed the 1,000th death from COVID-19 this week. Dominic Anthony Walsh with Texas Public Radio's Petri Dish podcast traces the pandemic's local path from the start to now.
There was a time when COVID-19 felt far away, abstract. For Dr. Ruth Berggren, the director of the UT Health Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics and Bexar County's medical advisor, the gravity of the then novel coronavirus first became tangible in January, when New York City began preparing for a potential outbreak.
You couldn't help but think this is a globally significant event. And it just went on from there, and things continued to build and build and build.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment.
At the time, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump was the bright, shiny object dominating every news program. But a new event quickly came into focus.
Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say a plane carrying Americans possibly exposed to the coronavirus in China will arrive at Lackland this week. There, they'll be quarantined.
Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland became a quarantine site for American travelers from Wuhan and passengers from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in February. By early March, the CDC had already incurred the wrath of local officials for transporting COVID-positive patients to area hospitals for treatment. And then...
San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg is not happy.
As mayor of this city, I find it totally unacceptable that CDC would release a patient prior to receiving all test results and potentially expose the public to this harm.
The mayor's referring to an evacuee from Wuhan, China.
The evacuee was released after two negative COVID tests, but then a third test came back positive, after they had already visited a mall. Health officials believe the mistake is unlikely to have spread COVID-19, but it's impossible to know. On March 13th,
this person began showing symptoms earlier this month, tested positive for COVID-19 yesterday, March 12th.
The first travel-related case in San Antonio was confirmed. And on March 19th, the first case of community spread. San Antonio and Bexar County issued a series of sweeping emergency orders. First, large gatherings were banned.
The mayor's order reduces the number of people in a mass gathering from 500 down to 50.
Next, some businesses were closed and capacity limited.
San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says it was a difficult decision because of the impact to workers in the industry.
Those folks are keeping me up all night.
A few days later, in late March,
a woman in her 80s was being treated at Brooke Army Medical Center and had a history of underlying health issues. She died Saturday.
The first in more than 1,000. Over the next few months, a power struggle between the state and local governments intensified. Texas wasn't doing nearly enough testing in April to know exactly how widespread the disease was. But even as daily cases steadily rose, Governor Greg Abbott overruled local authorities. On May 1st,
Texas restaurants, retail stores, malls, and movie theaters can reopen at 25% capacity. So can museums and libraries.
And then, just in time for Memorial Day,
you might be able to go to a bar today, but you won't be able to sit at the, well, bar.
Bars reopened with some restrictions. Governor Abbott also stripped local governments of the ability to enforce mask orders. In a moment of private candor that was secretly recorded, the governor acknowledged the likely effects of the fast reopening.
The fact of the matter is, pretty much every scientific and medical report shows that whenever you have a reopening, whether you want to call it a reopening of business or just a reopening of society, in the aftermath of something like this, that actually will lead to an increase in spread. It's almost ipso facto. The more that you have people out there, the greater the possibility there is for transmission.
It was an astute prediction. Dr. Drew Harris is a population health analyst and an assistant professor at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia.
You see, you have an infection and you take an antibiotic. They always tell you, take all the pills in the bottle, because if you stop halfway through, even though you're feeling better, you've gotten the infection under control, you haven't totally eradicated it, the infection will come roaring back again.
Crowds gathered and bars filled over Memorial Day weekend. 2 weeks later, cases began to surge. But at the time, in mid-June, Governor Abbott didn't sound too concerned.
We're here today to let Texans know about the abundant hospital capacity that exists to treat Texans who may test positive for COVID-19.
His reasoning was fraught. Confirmed cases typically follow exposure by 1 to 2 weeks, and hospitalizations generally follow confirmed cases by a week to 10 days. COVID-19 is a slow-motion disaster in that way. Abundant hospital capacity can become scarce when you have thousands of new cases every day. At the time, local officials pushed back on the reopening, like Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo. She told Houston Public Media that Abbott was correct about hospital capacity, but...
This is not the time to tempt fate. We have to get ahead of this, and it's not a matter of finding how far we can push before our hospital system enters into crisis.
Cases continued to surge. In a stark turnaround, Governor Abbott eventually closed bars in late June and issued a statewide mask order in early July. But by July, hospitals around the state entered into a crisis. Texas made national headlines. A CNN team parachuted into San Antonio.
We are having an explosion of COVID. We aren't overrun yet, but it's overwhelming.
Overwhelming now and expected to get worse in the days ahead.
On July 9th, San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg spoke at the daily COVID-19 briefings as deaths continued to rise.
Good evening. I'm Mayor Ron Nirenberg.
At the time, the city had 165 total deaths.
Behind every data point is a person with a life lived Our hearts are with their families, their friends, and their loved ones. Our hospital systems tonight remain under high stress. We do have
2 months later, that figure is more than 1,000. Texas as a whole now has more reported deaths than whole countries, like Chile, Germany, China, and Canada. San Antonio alone has more reported deaths than the entire continent of Australia. Now, daily cases are falling, but community spread is still active, just as classrooms reopen and as high school and college sports resume. And we won't know the full impact of a busy Labor Day weekend until mid to late September, just before the flu season starts. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. You may have seen her image on murals, a young woman, an Army specialist, beautifully made up. But you see her surrounded by angels and flowers, and you know she's dead. The brutal murder of Fort Hood Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen continues to incite calls for massive changes in the way the U.S. military handles sexual assault and harassment in its ranks. Before her death, Guillen's family says she told them she was being sexually harassed by an Army sergeant, but she worried about what would happen to her if she filed a complaint. A new bill introduced by a handful of Republican and Democratic lawmakers in Congress on Wednesday, called the I Am Vanessa Guillen Act, aims to ensure survivors of sexual assault and harassment and violent crimes on U.S. military bases, quote-unquote, are taken seriously and treated with respect, and assailants are held accountable. Jackie Speier is a Democratic congresswoman from California's 14th District. She's also chair of the House Armed Services Military Personnel Subcommittee, and she is the lead author of the I Am Vanessa Guillen Act, and she joins us now. Congresswoman Speier, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Joy.
Why carry this bill? You're in California. Vanessa Guillen was in Texas, but you decided to carry this bill. Why?
I've been working on the issue of sexual assault and sexual harassment in the military for 10 years. And every year we get a little additional improvement, but we don't get the kind of massive reform that's necessary to protect the 120,000 service members who are sexually harassed a year with only 1% reporting, and the over 20,000 that are assaulted each year in which only 5,000 report. It's an epidemic of which the military has been reluctant to take seriously and has tried to sweep under the rug.
Why in the military do you think that there is this issue with sexual abuse when there is this whole ethos of camaraderie and brotherhood and, you know, we're here for each other? Why?
You know, it's so hard to understand. I've talked to so many service members who have been victims of sexual assault, and their cry is always, I was prepared to fight the enemy outside. I wasn't prepared to fight the enemy inside.
Since you've been so passionate about this issue for a decade or over a decade, I wonder what did you put in the act to ensure that it was not just baby steps, but that it would take you really to the place where you want it to be? Can you describe what's in the act?
Yes. It makes sexual harassment a crime under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It creates
which carries what consequence?
Well, it can carry a consequence of jail and fines and discharge.
I see. Beyond
that, we create, and this is where the core of the legislation is, we create a chief prosecutor that's independent of the chain of command. Mm-hmm. So the chief prosecutor and an independent investigations unit will make a decision whether or not to pursue these cases. It also provides a means by which a victim can file a claim for compensation from the military for the injuries that they have incurred. It also requires the General Accountability Office and the Department of Defense to do an absolute scrub of the prevention program, the sexual assault prevention program, and the missing persons policy within the military.
Now, you are coming to Fort Hood tomorrow. There's been a lot of cases out of Fort Hood, not just of sexual assault, but of other missing service people. What do you hope to accomplish with this tour? And are you going to be speaking to senior commanders at Fort Hood?
There are 8 other members of the House of Representatives that will be joining me on this congressional delegation. We will be meeting with senior leaders within Fort Hood, some of whom have now transitioned because of Vanessa Guillen's case and Elder Fernandez's case and Private Morales's case. Beyond that, we're going to be meeting with enlisted female service members. We're going to visit the locations of where Vanessa was last seen,
oh, wow,
where her body was found. There's something really troublesome at Fort Hood. So we're going to look at many of those issues.
We've been speaking with California Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier. She's the lead author of the I Am Vanessa Guillen Act, introduced by her and several Republican and Democratic lawmakers yesterday. Congresswoman Speier, thank you so much for being here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Joy, for putting a spotlight on this issue.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. I want to welcome back Wells Dunbar. He's our social media editor. Wells.
Hey, Joy. Good to be back with you. Well, you know, the coronavirus, COVID-19, the big story, not going anywhere anytime soon, it appears. You and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, this discussion about when a vaccine might be available and a so-called return to normal might occur. I'm looking here and I see the Centers for Disease Control Director Robert Redfield said that broad access to a vaccine, well, not likely for some 6 to 9 months after its approval. This in contradiction of what the president himself has been saying, sort of promising a, a November or October surprise.
He has a very optimistic outlook about it. I mean, Anthony Fauci says he begs to differ with the president.
Exactly. Yes, and lots of folks taking issue with, as you put it, that optimistic outlook on Facebook. Tim Anderson says, up until recently, this is what we all expected, this timeline of being well into the next year before it was widely available. Then Tim adds that the president stuck his nose into it, and all of a sudden it became this November. Now we are readjusting. Now we're just readjusting people's expectations back to reality. And speaking of this conversation about COVID-19 and masks and whatnot, real interesting reporting seemingly just dropped from the Washington Post talking about the issues facing the U.S. Postal Service.
Oh, I'm so glad you're mentioning that story.
Yeah,
super
really
interesting.
Yeah, super interesting. And apparently the Postal Service had a plan to send 5 reusable masks to every American in the country, but was scrapped by the Trump administration over what they describe as concerns that they would create a panic. But just a fascinating sort of alternate timeline there.
I'm so glad you mentioned it, because I mean, USPS is probably, everybody says, one of the favorite agencies in the country. And the headline is like, you know, it's that is newly released documents and they show deteriorating finances colliding with public health emergency, plus an election on top of that.
I know, real, so it's like, real somewhat of a perfect storm there. Yeah, definitely.
Yes,
so. So we'll share a link to that on our Twitter account. Retweet it right now, as a matter of fact.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Fascinating article
that
folks should take a listen at. And, you know, of course, the census, it's hard to overstate its sort of role in hand-in-hand with the Postal Service.
With the Postal
Continuing
Service.
To hear from tons of folks about that. So fill them out if you haven't already, folks.
Yes, 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 yes. Go fill out the census if you can. Thank you so much, Wells. There's a whole team behind the show, and it includes our partner stations, to everyone who makes the Texas Standard. Thank you. And to you listening, thank you. We value you. This is the Texas Standard, and I'm Joy Diaz. See you again tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.